Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Christian Science Monitor Daily Program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your substitute Sun Sounds reader for today. I'm reading the Tuesday, August 4th, 2026 edition of the Monitor. All of the articles are dated August 4th, so I hope you enjoy the program. I'll begin with this article, titled, Syria's New Parliament Has Limited Power, But Expectations Are High, by Taylor Luck, a special correspondent. The members of Syria's new parliament, called the People's Assembly, were not directly elected by voters. They do not belong to political parties and have largely shied away from speaking to the public and the press. They also don't have much authority over the government. Nonetheless, even with all those limitations, many Syrians are pinning their hopes on this legislative body for the success of their revolution. These MPs are from us, so we feel we have a representative and a voice, says Yasuf El-Kuad, who's from the city of Dara. They were our best chance to secure our rights and freedoms that were deprived from us by the former regime, and that we as a people died to secure. When Syria's parliament convened in Damascus, July 12th, for the first time since the downfall of the regime of Bashar al-Assad in late 2024, it represented more than the return of a legislature. Even under the shadow of a bombing days earlier that killed 10 people, lawmakers gathered to begin rebuilding one of the institutions on which stable societies depend, especially in a post-revolutionary context. Under the Assad regime, the parliament functioned as a ceremonial fig leaf that served political elites and passed laws that stripped ordinary Syrians of their basic rights. The main responsibilities of the new parliament are mostly legal and institutional. Lawmakers need to overhaul hundreds of laws still on the books from the Assad era. They need to draft a new constitution. They also face the expectations of an impatient public, demanding better living standards and justice after years of civil war and dictatorship. Parliament is the only chance for stability in Syria, says Talal Syed, a Damascus-based political and economic analyst. One-third of those in parliament were appointed by interim president Ahmad el-Shara. The rest were chosen through an indirect selection process, with input from local electoral colleges. Members of parliament came from Syria's different regions, minority groups, and tribes. Among them are a total of 22 women, along with former political prisoners from the Assad years, and many business owners. In interviews with the Monitor, legislators spoke of marathon days, nights, and weekends spent preparing draft laws for review in the months before Parliament was reopened. But they later withdrew their consent to be quoted for this article, pointing to new regulations that limit the freedom of lawmakers to speak with the news media. In the first sessions, the Parliament elected a constitutional lawyer as Speaker, instead of an ally of the interim president, and it named as Deputy Speaker a Christian woman activist who was appointed to the chamber by President Shara. Some immediate priorities include revamping laws governing women's rights, media freedoms, and business transactions. Several international companies are waiting for the assembly to ratify an investment law, before launching new projects in Syria. The transition to a new era requires a change in culture and new ties between citizens and parliament, says Dr. Maher Abedin, a Damascus-based sociologist. People are still adjusting and waiting to see if this is a real people's assembly, not an assembly riding on the back of the people. On the streets in Damascus, though, it's easy to find Syrians who are skeptical. We need water, fuel, our currency is down against the dollar, says Wasim, a Damascus taxi driver, as he sips coffee with friends. He gave only his first name so he could speak freely. I have zero expectations in Parliament, he says. As long as they are appointed and not directly elected by us, nothing will happen. Parliament is also expected to draft a new law allowing political parties to participate in political life, which analysts say is critical to the country's transition. But statements from government officials and lawmakers suggest that getting parties registered is not at the top of the assembly's agenda. Political parties are the key way people can take part in the decision-making process, says Mr. Saeed, the analyst. If Parliament does not make this a priority and there is no political life, it will further alienate citizens. Perhaps the most urgent issue facing Syrian lawmakers is the public demand to see transitional justice and accountability for the crimes and human rights violations committed during the Assad years. Parliament would need to pass a law giving a mandate to the country's nascent National Commission for Transitional Justice and courts to put former officials on trial, provide reparations, and the return of stolen property. The commission's remit amounts to a Herculean task for the future. The Assad family was in power for more than half a century, and the number of Syrians who were killed or who disappeared, along with the myriad ways the former regime stripped citizens of land, money, and other assets, puts immense pressure on Parliament to act. Maha is an internally displaced Syrian woman living on the outskirts of Damascus, whose husband and two sons were killed by the Assad regime. She spoke to the monitor using only her first name in order to share her frank opinion, saying, "After getting no help from the new government, Parliament is my last hope. We are living in a tent. Our home is destroyed. Our money was stolen by the regime," says Maha, who makes ends meet by selling vegetables and relying on financial support from relatives in Europe. Parliament must pass a law for transitional justice so we can regain our rights and livelihood. Otherwise, we Syrians cannot start to rebuild our lives. Post-revolution, even skeptical Syrians say that should this parliament fail, the public still has leverage. We have lived through statelessness, hunger, death, and oppression to gain this opportunity, says Mr. Al-Quad. We will be patient. But still, he adds, if the MPs do not serve us, we will throw them out and select a new one. And that completes the first article today. Syria's new parliament has limited power, but expectations are high. By special correspondent Taylor Luck. Our next article is the U.S. needs more electricity. Can the grid deliver? By Monitor staff writer Laurent Belsey. In many ways, America's bureaucracy-laden electric grid has been like an old farm wagon, slow-moving, showing its age, and still operating under the assumption that electric demand grows slowly and consistently. Now industry and government want to hook that wagon up to a Ferrari. The artificial intelligence industry is building power-hungry data centers across the country in a race to keep ahead of surging AI demand. At the same time, non-AI sectors, such as electric vehicles and new construction, are also dialing up demand. That dynamic is shaking the electric power industry to its core. Yet the biggest article to meeting that demand is not more electricity generation, it's modernizing the regulatory and infrastructure choke points that are slowing the construction of new power plants and keeping already available energy from reaching the people who need it most. How big is the challenge, and what are the obstacles? Upgrading the electric grid is a major challenge. The United States last year installed 53 gigawatts of new electric power capacity, the biggest annual increase since 2002, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. This year, that number could reach a record 86 GW. Still, such increases might not be enough to meet the surging demand, and obstacles remain. Many Americans don't want power plants built or electric lines strung near their homes, and building a traditional power plant is costly, so electric power companies and regulators are cautious, hesitating to construct plants unless future demand is guaranteed. The AI industry, by contrast, turns on a dime, and while it's booming now, there's no guarantee that the boom won't turn into a bust if the industry consolidates into one or two winners. Perhaps the biggest challenge of all is bureaucratic delay in modernizing the grid, which can cause planned energy projects to be canceled altogether. What's being done to add capacity? Power plants are being built rapidly. In some cases, AI companies are building their own plants to power data centers, bypassing the grid entirely. To get local approval, they've also signed pledges that their projects won't raise local utility bills. The Trump administration is moving to ease environmental and other regulations so that power plants can be built more quickly. For the first 11 months of 2025, the nation installed some 4.2 GW of gas-fired generating capacity, more than double the capacity from the same period a year earlier, according to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. That is enough electric capacity to power millions of homes. Another potential winner is nuclear power in the form of small and mid-sized plants that can be built more quickly than traditional big power plants. Nuclear is having this amazing wave of investment, Evelyn Wang, an engineering professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and former director at the federal government's Advanced Research Projects Agency Energy, said at a Houston energy conference in March. But the biggest winner might be green energy, despite the administration's attempts to slow or kill such projects. Many companies have embraced solar and wind power installations because they are quick and relatively easy to put up. In that same 11-month period last year, the nation added 10 times more solar than natural gas capacity, and wind was double the natural gas total. The demand for power is that wind and solar are shifting from serving as alternative sources of energy to being part of the nation's energy core. Industry analysts say it's still early days, and it's not yet clear which of the competing technologies will emerge as winners. Isn't green energy fickle, dependent on the sun and wind? Yes, solar and wind are intermittent energy sources, but power companies are getting around that by deploying battery storage to capture that power when it's produced and feed it onto the grid when it's needed. In states like Texas and California, the speed of battery deployment is truly extraordinary, says Sally Benson, a Stanford University professor who served as chief energy transition strategist at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy during the Biden presidency. Since 2019, California's battery storage capacity has exploded by some 2,000%. On many nights from about 6 p.m. to 10 p.m., the state's number one source of electricity is stored energy from lithium-ion batteries, she says. When will capacity catch up to demand? Delays connecting new power plants to the grid are hampering progress. At the end of last year, planned facilities totaling more than 2,060 GW of power and storage had hookup applications pending. The queue is long, and the approval process is slowing. Because of that delay, most of those plants won't get built, concluded the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in a recent report. Of power developers' applications filed between 2000 and 2019 to connect projects to the grid, only 13% of the proposed new capacity had reached commercial operations by the end of 2024. Since the beginning of the 2000s, the average wait time for approval has doubled to more than 4 years. A related problem: insufficient transmission lines to carry the energy from where it's produced to where it's needed. Various estimates suggest that in the next 4 years, the nation will have to expand transmission systems by 60%, the Department of Energy reports. By 2050, the nation might need triple today's capacity. The grid is old and it needs to be fixed, says Roger Dewan, a vice president for S&P Global Energy. And there is a little bit of pain in doing that. But the fact that we have large customers who are merging, who want more energy faster, but also are capable of providing the capital for it, is very important. And in a way, it will solve a lot of the problems. And that completes the article. The title was "The U.S. Needs More Electricity. Can the Grid Deliver?" by staff writer Laurent Belsey. The title of our next article is "Why the U.S. Propped Up Japan's Struggling Yen" by staff writer Howard LaFranchi. When TV cameras zoomed in on Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent's notepad on Friday's cabinet meeting at Camp David, they captured a striking item on his to-do list: buy Japanese yen, JPY, $5 to $10 billion. The note referred to the extraordinary action to support the beleaguered Japanese currency from a 40-year low. Speaking with reporters, President Donald Trump acknowledged they wanted a little bit of help and were always there for Japan. But the U.S. action was not entirely altruistic. the price in Japan of U.S. exports, the potential impact on U.S. interest rates of a stubbornly low yen, and the economic impact that instability in a group of seven countries could have in Asia and throughout the global financial system were also factors. The rare U.S. intervention in Japan, the first in nearly 30 years, has drawn some comparisons to President Trump's $20 billion loan to Argentina last October, aimed at rescuing a falling peso. There, too, Mr. Trump was intervening on behalf of a, quote, friend, Argentine President Javier Milei. For some international economics experts, the U.S. effort suggests a new era of what some are calling currency activism, a perspective that gained traction after comments by Mr. Bessent on August 3rd. Friday's coordinated foreign exchange actions countered disorderly yen movements, he wrote on X. We will not hesitate to participate in further joint intervention. Indeed, the U.S. decision to purchase billions of yen, while effective in the short term, is not likely to be a one-time action, says Joseph Foudy, a clinical professor of economics and expert in Asian economies at New York University's Stern School of Business. That's especially the case with the yen still not that much above its four-year low last week. The intervention has injected some caution into the speculators who were betting against the yen, Dr. Foudy says, but it's unlikely to be enough of a response to keep this from happening again. He cites two key motivations of self-interest behind the U.S. action in Japan. First, a constant weakening of the yen widens the U.S. trade deficit as it makes Japan's exports to the United States cheaper and U.S. exports more expensive. The second concerns interest rates. Without a coordinated international effort to strengthen the yen, Japan might move on its own to sell U.S. treasuries it holds to finance a currency rescue. Such a move could jolt the bond market, pushing up interest rates as it gets harder to attract buyers for the bonds that finance the huge U.S. debt. In turn, that could slow the American economy by raising the cost of credit more broadly. Currently, Japan's benchmark interest rate stands at 1%. Having actually been raised in June by the Bank of Japan, while the U.S. rate stands at 3.75%. The Federal Reserve left the rate unchanged at its July Board of Governors meeting, but suggested a rate increase might be on the table in September if inflation pressures mount. More broadly, the coordinated U.S.-Japan action underscored growing concerns over stresses in the global financial system at a time of deepening U.S. national debt and huge new borrowing to finance AI development. Secretary Bessent will host his colleagues from the Group of 20 Nations at a meeting in Asheville, North Carolina, at the end of this month. The gathering will already face the pressures on the global economy from the energy reverberations of the Iran war and from President Trump's tariffs, without also having to consider a major currency challenge. The risk is far lower for the U.S. than last year's loan to Argentina, Dr. Foudy says. Argentina has defaulted 9 times on its international debt, most recently in 2020. There, it was a highly political move. The U.S. rescue came just days before a crucial midterm legislative election that would determine the fate of Mr. Malai's drastic libertarian economic reforms, reforms the Trump administration wanted desperately to see succeed. Japan is a very different story. It is the fact that they are our ally, but it is also true that we are giving them this help at little cost to ourselves, Dr. Fauci says. When you can help out an ally at little cost to you, and when it's in your self-interest, why not do it? And that ends the article. The title was Why the U.S. Propped Up Japan's Struggling Yen, by Monitor staff writer Howard LaFranchi. I'll take just a minute out of the broadcast to remind those of you who may have tuned in late, you're listening to the Christian Science Monitor Daily Program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your substitute reader today for the Monitor. I'm reading the Tuesday, August 4th, 2026 issue. I'll continue with the broadcast with a look at the news briefs for today. The first brief is brought to us by the Monitor staff. European Union ministers held emergency meeting about migrants in Ceuta. Around 70,000 people entered the Spanish city on the north coast of Africa after swimming from neighboring Morocco. Most have now been returned. More than 70 people died in the attempt. In the video conference meeting, member states sought to identify where further cooperation between states is needed and how to develop better early warning systems. But there have also been tensions within Europe. Italy received support from Denmark and Finland when it announced it was suspending its free movement agreement with Spain for 1 month. The second item, brought to us also by the Monitor staff, the Department of Justice announced a settlement with OpenAI. A $3.2 million settlement concerns allegations that the artificial intelligence giant and a subsidiary discriminated against U.S. workers in their hiring practices, instead favoring workers with temporary employment visas. OpenAI, the parent company of ChatGPT, is preparing for an IPO, though the company may not go public until next year, as it seeks a $1 trillion valuation. Next, Todd Blanche's nomination for Attorney General clears key hurdle. The Senate Judiciary Committee voted 12-1 on party lines to advance Todd Blanche's nomination for Attorney General. Republicans Tom Tillis and John Cornyn had said they would oppose the nomination until Mr. Blanche guaranteed in writing that the administration's $1.8 billion anti-weaponization fund, which they feared could be used to pay January 6th rioters, would not move forward. Mr. Blanche, the acting attorney general, provided a statement affirming the fund was dead. Mr. Cornyn and Mr. Tillis joined their colleagues in sending his confirmation to a vote by the full chamber. And that came from the Monitor staff. Also from the Monitor staff, 24 states have sued to block Trump's latest round of tariffs. The lawsuit filed in the U.S. Court of International Trade on Monday by a coalition of 25 states claims that the tariffs have been levied illegally. The administration says the tariffs, which went into effect last month, are needed to combat forced labor practices. The states claim that this reasoning is pretextual and that the tariffs regime is arbitrary, capricious, and overbroad. This is Mr. Trump's second attempt at enacting a global tariff regime. The U.S. Supreme Court struck down his first attempt in February. Next, arrest made in Spokane wildfire that's destroyed hundreds of structures. The Spokane County Sheriff's Office said that a previously convicted felon was arrested Monday on suspicion of arson. Authorities said they believe the man is linked to the wildfire that has forced the evacuation of tens of thousands in Spokane, Washington. The fire remained uncontained, but improving weather conditions gave firefighters a brief reprieve. The Old Trails fire was initially reported August 1st and had burned more than 3,000 acres by Tuesday. And that comes from the Monitor staff. French and British teams rescue 157 migrants after a boat fire in the Channel. French and British teams have rescued 157 migrants trying to cross the Channel after their boat's engine caught fire. The incident happened Tuesday morning in France's search and rescue zone near British waters. French maritime authorities deployed two rescue ships, a Navy helicopter, and medical personnel. Britain's Royal National Lifeboat Institution and Border Force also responded. The rescue operation brought 157 people to safety, with 103 rescued by French vessels and 54 by British vessels. All were taken to Boulogne-sur-Mer in northern France for medical assessment. Last week, four people died in separate attempts to cross the Channel. And that comes to us from the Associated Press. Also from the Associated Press, man dies in immigration jail in New Jersey. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement said Monday that Edwin Lopez Carneyo, a Salvadorian national, had been held at Delaney Hall in Newark after being arrested in June for allegedly entering the country illegally. The facility has been the target of months of protests over living conditions. His death is the second there since the beginning of President Donald Trump's second term. Civil rights groups have questioned whether people detained at the 1,000-bed facility were receiving proper care. The Trump administration has defended the center's operations. The facility is owned by Geo Group, a private prison contractor that runs multiple detention centers across the country. The contractor did not respond to a request for comment. And that comes from the Associated Press. And lastly, from the Monitor staff, Europe's rivers hit record lows in drought. Critical waterways such as the Danube and Rhine are well below normal flow, disrupting shipping, farming, and power generation. Romania declared a nationwide energy emergency after electricity production plummeted. It shut down one nuclear reactor and resorted to emergency rock blasts to redirect water in order to keep another operating. Hungary's Pax nuclear plant has had to reduce output. Receding waters revealed mammoth bones in Bulgaria and a wartime bridge in Germany. And those are the news briefs for today, August 4th, 2026. Continuing on with the articles that were published today, August 4th, in the Monitor. In China, motherhood begins with sitting the month. The tradition is spreading. by staff writer Ann Scott Tyson. Of course I set the month. All Chinese mothers do, says Gao Pai, a kindergarten teacher turned stay-at-home mom, cradling her seven-month-old son on a recent outing in Beijing. Ms. Gao extols the benefits of the ubiquitous Chinese tradition of sitting the month, or Zua Yi Zai, when new mothers rest, stay indoors, bundle up, and eat nourishing soups and other dishes for a month after giving birth. Relatives or other helpers care for the mother and baby, ensuring a smooth postpartum recovery. First recorded more than 2,000 years ago in the Chinese Book of Rites, this ancient practice has endured for centuries, even as it has evolved for modern mothers. Stringent old rules, taboos, and social roles have given way, including the requisite that new mothers eat a dozen eggs a day and don't bathe, and now women recuperate more flexibly at home or even in spa-like postpartum centers. China's sitting the month tradition is also inspiring new approaches to postpartum care overseas. The Chinese tradition is wonderful, says Diana Lari, professor emerita of history at the University of British Columbia, who has studied Chinese grandmothers' involvement in mother-baby care. So much has changed, yet somehow Zua Yezi has survived. Upscale experience. Ma Quine, a mother of two and children's clothing shopkeeper in Beijing, says families nowadays take a more scientific approach to sitting the month, allowing showers and other modern hygiene habits. And whereas traditionally a woman's mother-in-law took charge, strictly enforcing the rules, many women now rely instead on their own mothers. This avoids relationship issues, Ms. Ma explains. It's a lot of work, changing diapers, wiping bottoms, and it's smoother with her own mother, or with hired help. At one center in Beijing, Wang Can and her husband relax in a hotel-like suite, admiring their newborn daughter in her bassinet. A nanny offers around-the-clock infant care so the couple can sleep. The center, which opened in 2023, provides three healthful meals a day, such as fish and chicken soup, which are seen as good for mother's milk production. It also offers parenting classes, massage, and yoga rooms. Attendants help mothers shower with herbal treatments. A small swimming pool is available for infants to float in. The price tag for such care? From $12,000 to $19,000 for a month-long stay, depending on the room size, puts it out of reach for many couples, but those who can afford it enjoy a month of repose and pampering. It saves us a lot of trouble, says Ms. Wang, lounging in pajamas. A car picked me up after the birth and will deliver me home. We have everything we need. China now has thousands of postpartum care centers scattered across its cities, catering mostly to upper-class urbanites. The industry is booming across East Asia, too. South Korea's Ministry of Health and Welfare reports that roughly 85% of new mothers opt to recover at postpartum care centers. But it remains relatively rare in the West. Sitting the month in the West. Julia Kim thought she was hyper-prepared for her first child's birth in the United States in 2018. But despite all the books she's read and veteran moms she'd quizzed, she felt quickly overwhelmed. The nurses wheel you up to your recovery room and just leave you with your newborn. That was really startling, she says. The recovery period and learning the baby skills was a lot more difficult than I ever imagined. After a similar experience with her second child, in 2023, Ms. Kim decided to launch a postnatal retreat within a boutique hotel in Tysons, Virginia. Her inspiration came from a Korean friend who told her about South Korean postpartum care rituals, which closely resemble China's sitting the month. She combined these practices with modern American standards and opened a center called SANU. For about $1,250 a night, SANU offers 24-hour infant care, lactation support, massage therapy, meals, and parenting classes, giving parents a chance to rest, refresh, and connect with their baby. You are not compelled to walk the dog or do the dishes, she says. You are there in a focused setting for your recovery and bonding. Ms. Kim also believes that extra support for mothers and babies in the early weeks could offer health benefits, noting that maternal and infant mortality rates are higher in the U.S. than in East Asian countries. She hopes her retreat can help normalize the concept in the U.S. As we scale as an industry, it will become more accessible, she adds. Keeping it homey. While fancy facilities such as Ms. Kim's are becoming more popular, sitting the month remains for many a warm, homey ritual. Nutritionist and anthropologist Georgine Luang was in London expecting her first child when her mother arrived from Hong Kong, bringing Cantonese sitting the month customs that would come to fascinate her. These include the consumption and sharing of ginger-heavy pork knuckle stew, seen as an energy-boosting tonic for new mothers. Peeled fresh ginger is added to a large pot, along with a sweet, dark Vinegar One brand, has babies on the label, sold in specialized shops in Hong Kong. These are cooked slowly for 1 to 2 months after the birth, and later pork knuckle and eggs are added. The mother shares portions of the stew with family and friends as a kind of birth announcement, and then consumes the rest little by little, over several months. Ms. Luang, who is writing her doctoral dissertation on postpartum practices in Hong Kong, grew to appreciate the broader cultural and social importance of sitting the month. Becoming a mother is a huge life transition for a woman, not just having a child, but the change of all the roles in the family, she says. For family harmony, Zhua Yixing needs to be done properly, she says. And that completes the article. The title was, In China, Motherhood Begins with Sitting the Month. The Tradition is Spreading, by staff writer Ann Scott Tyson. Next up is The Monitor's View by the Monitor's editorial board. The title is Africa Plows a Different Growth Path. Foreign investors and African governments are boosting agricultural productivity and exports that blend business and social benefits, creating new models for economic development. Perhaps more so than in other parts of the world, Africa has been jolted by global trade shocks, epidemics, and climate uncertainties in recent years. At the same time, foreign aid has slowed to a trickle. Yet amid all this, the continent's one bright spot has been agriculture, which is evolving from subsistence farming into sustainable livelihoods. Investors from the Middle East, Asia, and Europe are putting money into African agriculture, seeding the ability of farmers there to intensify and diversify their crops and livestock with an eye toward processing raw materials for export. These investments signal a shift from resource exploitation by outside interests to an approach that recognizes African countries as reliable producers and trade partners. African agriculture is rapidly becoming a proving ground for global investment, according to Bloomberg News. Recent investment deals blend commercial interests with social development projects, such as building infrastructure, creating permanent jobs, and sharing technological know-how. This framework, Bloomberg observed last October, can improve productivity for the benefit of the host country and its overseas backers. Last year, the European Investment Bank deployed one-third of its portfolio in Africa, or 3.1 billion euro, about $3.57 billion, with an emphasis on improving agriculture value chains. This year, China eliminated tariffs on goods from 53 of 54 African nations after okaying a range of new agricultural imports. Qatar has put in $1.5 billion to improve irrigation in Ghana, helping create an estimated 2,500 jobs. And Angola has signed co-production agreements for local farmers with Brazil and the United Arab Emirates that will retain 40% of output within the country. These investments are spawning agripreneurs who are turning to digital platforms, communication, and data to enhance productivity and marketing. Analyst Landry Signe of the Washington-based Brookings Institution argues that Africa is well-positioned to harness the latest technologies, to leapfrog to new food production methods. Tech-savvy farmers are boosting employment, trade, and new agriculture-related companies. This mix, the economist wrote this week, could be a boon for Africa and force a rethink of what is meant by farming and manufacturing. In 2024, the African Development Bank Group estimated the continent's food and agribusiness industry would surge almost fourfold by 2030, reaching $1 trillion. With a total population greater than that of India or China, Africa has an estimated 60% of the world's remaining uncultivated yet arable land. Instead of seeking to follow the industrialization paths pursued by Asia and Latin America in recent decades, the continent has an opportunity for a different growth model, one suited to its priorities and potential. And that is the Monitor's view today. Africa plows a different growth path, by the Monitor's editorial board. Our final article today is titled, On Blanche Vote, Cornyn and Tillis Say Their Holdout Was About Principle, by staff writer Caitlin Babcock. Politics watchers have a nickname for a group of lame duck senators in Congress, the YOLO Caucus, using the acronym You Only Live Once, to imply that these senators are more emboldened now that they have little to lose. Their pushback stands out in a Republican Party whose members rarely oppose President Donald Trump's administration. In recent weeks, Senators John Cornyn of Texas and Tom Tillis of North Carolina bottled up Mr. Trump's nominee for Attorney General while demanding an end to the administration's planned $1.8 billion fund to pay people who claim the Justice Department has been weaponized against them. Hours after voting yes in committee to help send Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche's nomination to the full Senate, Mr. Cornyn rejected the YOLO label. I don't think you can explain everything up here based on personalities, Mr. Cornyn, who lost his primary in May, said during an interview. This was strictly based on concern about the merits of the arrangement. So it's not about payback. It's not about YOLO. During a public meeting before the Judiciary Committee vote, Mr. Tillis, who is retiring, also spoke about principle as opposed to feeling freer to express his views without having to align with the administration or the Republican caucus. Instead of criticizing people on the other side of the aisle, why don't you go back and hold your own conference to a higher standard? Said Mr. Tillis at Tuesday's hearing. This is what I'm doing. This is what Senator Cornyn is doing. And this is what I think the American people want more of. Mr. Trump has said Mr. Cornyn never had a problem with the fund until he was primaried. The president has continued to praise the fund, including as recently as Monday. Senators Cornyn and Tillis forced the administration to state in writing that the fund is permanently dead, making it politically challenging if they were to try to resurrect it at a later date. The statement also narrows Mr. Trump's immunity from IRS audits, clarifying that his immunity only applies retroactively. The Monitor asked a dozen other Republican senators, including two other members of the Judiciary Committee, what they thought about the deal. All declined to comment, except Tommy Tuberville of Alabama, who said, "It's all about getting reelected up here," and that he supported the anti-weaponization fund. The deal has come under criticism by Democrats, including Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland, who says it's not legally binding. They say Mr. Blanche did not rescind Mr. Trump's original settlement, and the administration could still create a separate fund to accomplish virtually the same goals. Mr. Cornyn told reporters, "It was the best we could do in these circumstances." The fund was part of a settlement Mr. Trump reached with the IRS after an agency contractor leaked his and his elder son's confidential tax returns. The idea received strong bipartisan backlash, particularly because of the possibility it could be used to pay those convicted of crimes committed during the January 6th, 2021 riot at the Capitol. In June, less than a month after it was announced, Mr. Blanche said during congressional testimony that the fund was dead. That didn't satisfy Senators Cornyn and Tillis, whose votes Mr. Blanche needed for his nomination to advance. They wanted confirmation in writing and received it just days before the vote. The date of the full Senate vote was not set as of Tuesday. And that completes the article on Blanche Vote. Cornyn and Tillis say their holdout was about principle. It's written by Monitor staff writer Caitlin Babcock. And that also ends the broadcast today. We have run out of time. You've been listening to the Christian Science Monitor Daily, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader. The articles I've been reading were published today, August the 4th, 2026, in the Monitor. I hope you enjoyed the program, and I hope you found it informative. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to the premium programming offered by Sun Sounds of Arizona on a 24/7 basis. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.